it was such a formative number of years for me, just being in a completely new environment, not knowing anyone there other than like the co-founder of the company that I was with, that where we didn't really hang out like that, right? So, you know, I would say thank you to, you know, 22, 23 year old me for, you know, taking that risk.
Welcome back to the Arena Podcast. I'm your producer, Nihar Nilakanti, and this podcast is hosted by Jeff Harbach, CEO of Kauffman Fellows. We have a great episode for you all today with Jeff hosting Marlon Nichols, founding managing partner of Cross Culture Ventures. Let's jump right into it. See you in the arena.
All right, we're back with Kauffman Fellows podcast, The Arena. My name is Jeff Harbach. I'm your host. We are on the road today. We are in Culver City, California, at the headquarters of Cross Culture Ventures with co-founder and general partner of Cross Culture Ventures, Marlon Nichols. We're excited to be here. Marlon, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We're glad to have you, man. So Marlon is a Kauffman Fellow from Class 18. And has a really unique background. We want to dive into that a little bit today and also talk about cross culture. But Marlon, first, you know, I didn't prep you for this, but we always like to ask. So give me something, give all of us something that is something that we can't learn about you from doing, you know, Facebook stalking you or LinkedIn stalking you. What's something that's kind of off balance sheet that maybe people wouldn't know about you?
I don't know if there is anything anymore.
Everything about you?
It's like all out there now. Yeah, I used to talk about that. I played on a semi-pro team when I lived in the UK for a while, but I think that's pretty widely known now. Let me see. Oh, funny story. When I was a teenager and I got my first car, this was like a used beat up car that my dad helped me get, and it was like running to the ground. And I was an athlete in high school, so in the evenings when we're out of season, I would drive up to this this basketball court, which is like three towns over, so you had to jump on the highway. So I now have my car, and I'm driving my three buddies, and all of a sudden we see smoke coming out of the hood, and we're like, okay, let me pull over. So I pull over, I open the hood, and then the flames just like everywhere. So we all like jump. They How jump out of the car. I was like 16. Jump out of the car and like roll down the hill. We thought it was going to blow up like in a movie. So that was interesting. So I never got a used car again after that.
Mental note, no buying any more used cars.
Got it. Pre-owns are good, but yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's something that nobody knows about you. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
All right, Marlon. So let's dig in a little bit. You know, here at the Kauffman Fellows podcast, we like to pull out the, you know, we think there's a hero's journey inside every Kauffman Fellow. And we like to hear the formative experiences of what made you who you are today. And let's start with your childhood. Like, tell me a little bit about what your childhood was like. Maybe some of the, you know, the memorable experiences, formative experiences you had as a kid.
Yeah. So I grew up in kind of two places. I was born in Jamaica, West Indies. And I lived there till I was about 7 or 8. And what was interesting there is that for like 2 to 3 years out of that time, I lived with an aunt because my parents had moved to the U.S. without me to kind of set up, you know, set things up, make sure I was coming to like a stable situation. And then I got to the U.S. and it was just completely like different. I spoke with an accent, so I got teased sometimes about that. Worked really hard to put aside my Jamaican patois. But it was just interesting growing up in two places. And then as I you know, as I got older, every summer I would still go to Jamaica and spend it with my grandmother. So it was an interesting kind of living in the U.S. and then going in the summers and living in basically what's the equivalent of almost a third world country, because I wasn't on the resorts. Like, I was at my grandmother's house, like, you know, in it. So it I don't know. I think it gave me perspective that not everyone lives the way that we do in the U.S. Like, even the poorest of people probably don't live like the poorest of people in the U.S. is very different than the poorest of people in Jamaica. So it's just, yeah, I think I got a good dose of perspective from being in those two places.
So your story, like many other stories in venture and in tech, is that of an immigrant story, and your parents came to the U.S. from Jamaica. Certainly they were trailblazers and heroes and maybe probably entrepreneurs in their own right. Like, what'd you learn from your parents kind of coming over here, blazing the trail first, bringing you over here after?
Yeah.
Tell me about your parents.
Yeah. So, you know, in Jamaica, my dad was a train engineer. When he moved to the U.S., he became a bus mechanic. So kind of a downshift. My mom, she was a beautician in Jamaica. When she first moved to the U.S., you know, she was a nanny and housekeeper, had to put herself back through beautician school or cosmetology school, and then, you know, started doing like hair in our kitchen. And, and, you know, to the point where she got good enough where then she went and found the job at a local beauty salon. And then that grew into her finding her own salon, which she's had for 20 something years now. So she was the first entrepreneur that I've, you know, known and kind of watched. So I guess I learned, you know, the whole concept of entrepreneurship and building a business from the ground up, and you know, the good things that can happen, the bad things that could happen, and everything in between, just from being in the house and growing up with her.
And so what does she think now about your investment in Maven?
Oh, she she likes it. She likes it a lot, actually. You know, I had introduced her to the platform like just when we were making the investment. It's like almost 4 years ago. So she loves it. Hopefully she'll be able to participate in a new iteration of the business, which is great. I guess I should say, for those of you that don't know, Maven's this mobile distribution platform that allows hairstylists to sell product without actually carrying product. And that's a really important thing for hairstylists in diverse communities, because their businesses are typically break even, and so they can't afford to carry that inventory risk. So Maven takes that away. But the new iteration of their business is even better. So now consumers will go directly to Maven, buy, for instance, hair, and then they'll be able to take that hair to select beauticians and have it installed or your hair done for free. And what's the magic in this is that at the end of the day, it costs the consumer about 40% less than what they're paying for this stuff now. And that's without taking any money out of the beautician's or hairstylist's pocket. So Maven's paid out something like $20 million over the last 4 or 5 years to hairstylists and commissions. And they're looking to increase that number. So
Maven's an exciting company. So Marlon, as you think about, you move over here from Jamaica, you're getting rid of or adjusting with your accent. You go through elementary, middle, high school. What were you thinking as an immigrant coming over here? What did you want to be? Like, did you have any visions of what you wanted to be when you grew up? What's maybe some people that you looked up to or wanted to be like? What was that for you?
I had no idea. I mean, I've always been good at sports. I ran track. I played basketball. Knew I didn't love track enough to be a track athlete, so I definitely didn't model any of them. I was a big fan of Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, and those guys, but I'm 5'9", didn't think that was going to be a realistic thing, although I was pretty good. I turned to, and then also, you know, being new to the country, I didn't have a lot of family members that were in, you know, different professions or anything like that. So there wasn't a lot for me to model or mirror. So when I ended up going to college and I had to pick a major, the only thing that I could think of was Mr. Brady from the Brady Bunch.
Okay.
Literally. How's that? Literally. Because I've always watched TV, right? I'm a big TV guy. And so I would watch the Brady Bunch after school.
Marlon Nichols, hailing from Jamaica, digging on the Brady Bunch. That is awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And but what was appealing to it was like, okay, here's this guy. He puts on like this suit every day to go to work, which is cool because I don't see that in my house, right, or in my family. Goes to some office and does some stuff and creates these buildings. And it looks like a fun career to have. And he's supporting like this massive family. So it's also lucrative, which is really, really important, you know, coming from my beginnings, like I got to find something that's going to pay like the bills and then some. Got to change this thing. So that's, yeah, I didn't know any, I hadn't drawn anything probably my whole life, maybe like a stick figure here and there, but that's it. And I go to school. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to be an architecture major, just like Brady. And I sucked at it. It was so bad because, you know, all the other kids in my class, you know, they've been drafting and doing all that stuff for years. And here I come, they're trying to figure it out now. It just wasn't going to work out. So I did it for a year, got decent grades, but you know, what took projects that would take my classmates, you know, an hour, maybe 2 hours to do, I was up till like 6 a.m. finishing the project. And then, you know, then waking up 2 hours later and going to class or whatever. So yeah, it wasn't going to work out.
Brutal. But you know what? That is the beauty of this podcast. You and I know each other really well. We've been friends for a long time. I'm not sure I ever would have gotten out of you the whole Brady Bunch story. That is fantastic. All right. So you move on. You go to college. You go to Northeastern University. Mm-hmm. Did you start to get a sense for some of the things that you were good at, you know, going through, again, adolescence, childhood, high school, now into college? What were some of the things that you felt like you were starting to feel like you were good at?
Well, I knew what I wasn't good at.
Okay. What were you good at?
I wasn't good at drawing and drafting.
For sure.
So then it was like, okay, well, I got to pick a major that I can, where I'll actually have an opportunity to enjoy college. And actually get good grades. And so I started looking around and, there was this new major at the time called Management Information Systems. And it was, and one of my buddies, this guy, Steve, he was in that major. So he would tell me about it. And then I thought back to my mom, was like, okay, well, she runs a business. So the business aspect of it seems important. Like if I'm going to ever do something professional, I should probably learn what is business and how to run them and do that stuff. And then the other part of it was technology. And, you know, I've been around video games. I had a Commodore 64, all that stuff. I knew I liked tech. I wasn't sure what I liked about it, but there was something that was appealing. And so the combination of those two things just pulled me. And then I couldn't find anything else that, you know, that I was even like remotely excited about. Like I wasn't going to be a biology major. It just didn't excite me. I wasn't, you know, I never wanted to be a lawyer or anything like that. So that wasn't going to, criminal justice didn't excite me. I was good at math, but not to the point where I wanted to be a mathematician. Mm-hmm. Didn't enjoy it like that. So that was my major.
Got it. Yeah. And so, okay, you go through, you start to figure out some of these things that you are good at and that you like. You graduate from Northeastern and you co-found Rise to College. Tell me about Rise to College and And more importantly, why was that important to you? Like, what role did that play in the journey of Marlon Nichols?
Wow, rise to college. I don't even think that's in my bio anymore. but yeah, that was like, you know, that was years later. That was after I had been in a startup and saw an exit there and spent a few years in my consulting career. And my consulting career just wasn't rewarding to me. And so I was looking for something that I can get excited and be passionate about and could create impact. And at the time, I was also starting to think about going back to business school. And I joined this program called Management Leadership for Tomorrow, which is a nonprofit focused on Black, Latinx, and Native American folks that are looking to get into competitive business schools.
Acronym that many people know it by is MLT.
Yeah, yep. And so then I started thinking like, okay, well, why isn't there something like this for high school? Because I could have used this when I was in high school thinking about colleges, because like literally the only colleges that I applied to were those that I got letters for or had phone calls with about potentially, you know, being an athlete there. Like that was my selection process.
Yeah.
I didn't prepare for the SAT or anything like that. I just took it and got what I got, right? My family didn't know any better. I didn't know any better. And so I was like, okay, well, this is a problem. And I feel like I can fix it. So I called up one of my buddies, this guy, Dale Burnett. So Dale now runs like one of the largest real estate funds in the country. And I said, Dale, like, I got an idea. We can do this thing. And also my buddy, Willie Williams, who's a hedge fund manager now. And we all had the same experience. And so we just started talking about it and said, all right, well, let's figure this out. So Rise to College was ultimately a nonprofit focused on inner city high school students, talented inner city high school students, and it giving them the tools necessary to apply successfully to competitive universities. So we partnered with this test prep organization called Bell Curves, who donated some of their services. We raised money to pay for some of the other services. And then Dale, Willie, and I basically wrote a curriculum on how to apply to college. And then, you know, at first we taught the curriculum. So we would, yeah, on Saturday mornings, we'd be at the Bell Curves office with the students and we would go over, you know, writing essays and doing the interview and, you know, researching schools and finding the schools that are best fit for you and all that stuff. And then Bell Curves would teach them how to take the SAT. And so, yeah, we ran that thing for, I want to say like 5 or 6 years while holding down full-time jobs as well. And, you know, we saw students go that believed that, I mean, these kids were really, really smart. But they thought, you know, I'm only going to be able to go to like a community college, or the situation of, you know, I'm the oldest kid in this like really large family and my family needs me to stay home and take care of my brothers and sisters. Even though I have this incredible brain. And so, you know, a big part of it was like seeing the paradigm shift, right? Them going from thinking, oh, I'm only going to go to community college, to going to Cornell, going to Wharton, going to Vassar, going to Vanderbilt on full scholarships. It was like a really, really rewarding thing to do.
It's amazing. You know, yeah. What I love about your story, Marlon, and your journey is, you know, you come from Jamaica. You come over here led by parents that are incredibly, you know, brave and trailblazing on their own. They set a path for you. You come over, you go to school here, you figured it out. You don't know necessarily what you don't know, which many of us go through that same feeling. We don't know what we don't know. And so you take the SAT and you get what you get because you don't know that there's all these prep courses and whatever else there is out there. You make it through college, you succeed in college. You go and get great consulting jobs and do these other things. And what do you do with your time? after that is you feel this need where, wow, there's so many other people that need to understand. We can help remove some of the things that they don't know. And so I think this is a path that I want to continue to kind of pull out of you in this talk, is that you're constantly looking for those that you want to remove the blind spots from, those that don't understand what's out there for them, and give them the opportunities. And I think that's a lot of what cross culture now, as we fast forward to cross culture, what cross culture stands for. Is that right? Tell me about cross culture.
Yeah. So when we set out to create cross culture, we were looking at intersections. So the intersection of pop culture, of professional athletics, of government, of people around the globe. And we came to the conclusion that the base element of consumer behavior is culture. And so we wanted to understand consumer behavior from a global perspective. And so that's where you get the cross culture thing, right? Cultures crossing, and picking out emerging behavioral trends from that, and then investing in companies that are building solutions that, you know, make sense for these trends that we're seeing and that we think are gonna go long. And a big part of that is looking at communities and people that you know, have been ignored for a long time, and the spending power and the, you know, the influence on popular culture that a lot of these communities have, like, throughout the world. And so, you know, what are some of these businesses, and who are these entrepreneurs that, you know, no one knows about yet? Right? Can we find them? Can we invest in them? You know, can these become multi-billion dollar opportunities? And, you know, can we pave the way? And so that was the idea initially around cross culture. And then also, you know, doing at the time, so this was what, 2014 going into 15, essentially, when we started the process, there was a big spotlight being you know, the lack of diversity and all that in Silicon Valley and startup and venture. And we said, this could be, you know, this is an opportune time, right? Like, we're going after something that dovetails really well with a problem that people are starting to see as a problem. And so that's kind of how we got started with it. We definitely wanted to make sure we were investing without bias, though. So we weren't going to be one of the funds that, you know, only invest in diverse founders. Like, we want to invest in the white guy too, right? As long as we care about, you know, what his company is building, and we feel like you know, his company can, you know, add real value in the world, right? And is poised to ride one of these trend waves that we think are going to be important going forward. And the other thing that it does, kind of a byproduct of thinking about investing in that way, is that, you know, no one can ever look at any of our founders, any of the founders that we've backed, and said, well, this was an affirmative action thing, or this was a diversity fund thing, so, you know, we're going to discredit or put an asterisk next to that investment. It's like, no, they got this investment because they're building something really important, and they're the best. This is the best team going, and they have the best approach going after this thing. Period.
So, period.
Yeah.
Period. Where did you find that? You know, that's what I was trying to lead up here, is you had all these experiences growing up to now building something as incredible with such a strong kind of mission and purpose as cross culture. Where did that spark come from? Where did the kind of the idea and the passion? I mean, I imagine it had been kind of brewing for many, many years, but what was the kind of aha moment where you're like, oh my gosh, this exists and now is the opportune time. I know you talked about 2014-15 with the lack of diversity in venture, which of course even still exists. Mm-hmm. But what was the spark for you that kind of said, this has to be done now, and I know exactly what we need to do?
Yeah. So I was going through my fellowship, right? And I was working at Intel Capital. And by this time, I was starting to get a little frustrated because the whole corporate VC thing, and Intel Capital was getting more and more strategic, and you know, with regards to the investments that we could make. So I knew I was going to leave Intel Capital at some point because there were just all these great deals out there that I wanted to do that just didn't fit with the thesis. During that time, you know, I helped my boss at the time, Lisa Lambert, to architect the diversity fund. So Intel had launched this $125 million diversity fund that targeted, you know, women and entrepreneurs that were Black, Latinx, and Native American. And I learned a lot while we were building that vehicle. One, you know, the level of pushback that, you know, that we got from, you know, different groups within the broader company, and some even within Intel Capital, of thinking that, you know, there wasn't going to be enough pipeline, and even if there was pipeline, that these weren't going to be, couldn't be mega companies because of who was founding them, which was kind of offensive, but we, you know, we fought through it and got it done. Well, she did most of the politics, and, you know, the bureaucracy, dealt with most of the politics and bureaucracy that went with that. So shout out to Lisa for doing that. Once we started investing and, you know, we would lead deals, and I'd have conversations with other investors about the deals that we were doing. And then we'd get questions around, well, is this a real Intel Capital investment? Because it's coming out of this other like diversity vehicle. Like, you know, can we trust that? Like, are you guys going to, you know, support them like you support other companies? And, you know, again, is this an affirmative action thing? And then I saw it even more so when these companies were going out for follow-on funding, just having to answer those questions. And so a part of my thinking on this was, you know, I think we have something here around, you know, this intersection thesis or this cross-cultural thesis, but we also have an opportunity to kind of change the narrative around, you know, what a diversity fund is, or should there even be a diversity fund, right? Shouldn't there just be a focus on investing in great founders, irrespective of what they look like, where they come from, where they were educated, et cetera. And that's what really, you know, it was pulling on me for a long time. And so that's a big part of, you know, where we came to with this.
That's awesome. And then you met your partner now, Troy Carter. What was that like, meeting Troy for the first time?
Yeah. So I didn't even know who Troy was, to be honest with you. You know, part of this was, you know, we do these field projects. I don't know what we call them now in the fellows program. The
Thought Leadership Project is now what they're called.
Yeah. Okay. The Thought Leadership Project. and so mine was around, you know, building this fund. And, you know, once I started, or we had a third co-founder at the time, started putting together a pitch deck and all that stuff, I targeted certain advisors that, you know, I felt like I needed to have around me to help me think about this and to help, you know, help guide me to creating this fund, because I'd never done it before, so needed help. And so one of those, or a couple of those advisors, was Frida and Mish Kapoor of Kapoor Capital, who've been mentors of mine for a while. And so I went to them and, you know, pitched them on the idea. They loved it and said, you know, we'll support you on this and we'll absolutely advise you. We have one thing that we need you to do, though, and that's to go meet with Troy. And so I was I needed to fly down to LA, and it was like 2 days later for another meeting anyway. So I flew down, and they made him like take the meeting, which, if you know Troy, he's so busy, like two days notice and being able to, you know, get an hour and a half is a lot. So yeah, so they meant a lot to him too, and he, you know, vice versa. So I came down, like, I don't know who this guy is, so I started Googling him and checking him out, and I'm like, okay, so entertainment manager, all right, cool. I was thinking, yeah, maybe he's got some money so I can get him to invest in the fund. And I dug a little bit deeper. I was like, oh, okay, he's doing some angel investing, and these are some pretty incredible companies. So I get down here, you know, pitch him on the whole thing. We connect, we had a real connection, see the world in a similar way. He's very philanthropic as well, and just has a big heart, right? Does a lot of community service, sits on a lot of nonprofit boards, all that stuff. So we vibed on a lot of different levels, family, everything. But at the end of the meeting, it's like, yeah, I'm not going to invest in this company because. Or this fund, because I do all my investing on my own, right? Off my balance sheet, yeah. And it's worked out pretty well.
I'm doing okay.
Yeah. And I don't, I don't need all the overhead and the bureaucracy and all this other stuff. So, all right, well, cool. It's great to meet you. And, you know, let's keep in touch. If I could be helpful, let me know. And then I think it was like 2 weeks later, and I was actually in a Kaufman module. We were in, I want to say it was like Burlingame or something like that. And I get this phone call, and it's like his assistant. And she's like, can you spare some time today to talk with Troy? I was like, okay, what do you want to talk about? And so we, so I think it's like a half hour later, I call in the number, and she's like, okay, please hold for Troy. And so I hold, and he gets on. He's just like, hey, man, I can't get this, you know, off my mind. Like, we should figure out how to do this thing together. And I was like, okay, well, what does that mean? Like, you know, me do all the work and you take all the credit? Right. Like, what does that mean? He was like, no, I think we should create a flat partnership and go and build this thing together, because I had aspirations of doing a traditional venture fund, and I wasn't able to find people to do it with, and I think I'd like to do it with you. And so we spent, you know, like 6 months or so getting to know each other. We did a lot of work with Bill Tobin at Strayer Consulting around, you know, just understanding our personality traits and how to deal with it when difficult things come about and all that stuff. And then we got to work on building the fund.
That's awesome. And actually, I do want to ask you about that. So you came in new partner, you already had a partner, partnership dynamics. I mean, Noam Wasserman says that 65% of businesses fail because of the human dynamic. That means partnerships are hard. You went through some different things in partnerships, trying to, as you said, working with Bill, trying to integrate a new partner. What'd you learn through the process about partnerships?
Yeah, I mean, so it's one of those things that you know, but I guess you don't really think about as much. It's just that, you know, people are complicated, and we're all different, and we all have our quirks and triggers and all that stuff. And you know, sometimes it works out and you can kind of get around that stuff, and sometimes it doesn't, right? I mentioned we had a third co-founder, you know, great guy, really smart guy, but at the end of the day, just like you know, the way that we ultimately saw or see the world is different. And so, you know, at some point the three of us had to sit down and have, you know, very difficult conversations, and we did that, and we got to the point that, you know, one of these kids is a little bit different than the others, and it's probably going to be it'll be better for everyone involved if, you know, if we parted ways. And so that's what we did. We did it amicably, and it was a good decision, because, you know, once that happened, we saw like our work just take a completely different direction. And no knock on him. He's a great guy. It's just a situation. Yeah.
Yeah. You free each other up. I mean, it's oftentimes in partnerships, when things aren't working, when you're having those difficult conversations, which are so important, at the end of the day, it frees each of you up to pursue, kind of your best self and your best work. Mm-hmm. So it's great that you had that. Switching gears a little bit, you know, your so much of your background, Marlon, and now with what you do with Cross Culture, it gives you a very unique perspective and a deep perspective into diversity or the lack thereof in entrepreneurship and in venture. I'd just love to hear your kind of, we could probably do a whole nother episode just on this, but it's been talked about a lot in our industry. What would you say about diversity? Are we headed in the right direction? What are some things that we need to do better to increase diversity, increase inclusion in our industry?
Wow. Big question.
Like I said, we could do a whole other podcast on this. But
Yeah. Big question. I think we're seeing some changes, particularly with women, white, Indian, and Asian women. In venture, making some strides, and you know, it takes a concerted effort, not only from that demographic, but from allies. And so, you know, we're seeing more and more funds, and then as a result of that, we're seeing more and more women get funding from those funds and others. We're also seeing, you know, some of the kind of big brand name firms that didn't have, women general partners naming women general partners. So that all helps. What I'd love to see next is that happen with, more diverse fund managers as well. So, you know, when will we see, you know, kind of the Latina or the Black woman GP at, Sequoia or wherever, right? I think once we start seeing that happen, we'll start seeing more people that look like them get funded, and we'll start seeing more challenges that affect the communities where they're from, get funding. And then also, I think At the LP level, something's got to change too. I think, you know, there's been a quote unquote mandate around investing in emerging managers for a long time, but we're not really seeing like 2% of venture, general partners that are like Black and Latinx, right? And it's, you know, it's been that way for a long time. So if there are mandates out there, they're not really working out. So I'd like this, it'd be great to see some real change happening at the LP level, where, you know, they're taking those meetings and they're taking them seriously, and they're putting dollars behind, the lip service that they're giving.
You were quoted once as saying, as a Black man, it felt like I had to prove more than some of my peers to push past unconscious and at times explicit bias to raise funds. You're not the only one that feels that way. You're certainly not the only one that is an African-American that feels that way, raising funds. I agree with you. We need to make this better, and it's incumbent upon all of us, whatever gender, ethnicity, background we're from, to make sure that we are a part of this solution. And a part of making that better for all that want to participate and can participate in entrepreneurship ultimately, because they are the true heroes in our story, and they're the ones that they need to be funded by those that are willing to fund them. Marlon, you have this incredible background of someone that has, gone through all these different experiences, and you now, it's not just talk for you. I mean, I know you spend a lot of time in teaching at Cornell and spending time with other universities and other groups and MLT. And there's so many ways that you give of your time. I think you must have a time machine because you have more hours in your day than anybody else. As you think about this, and here's kind of my final question for you, as you think about your life and all the formative experiences, the ups, the downs, the hero's journey that we all go through, kind of the wins, the losses, you've had a lot of those things. What I would love for you to do is, with the lens or with the mindset of you thinking about all those people that you're now mentoring and teaching and helping, especially those that come from backgrounds similar to yours, what I want you to do is I want you to pick a point in your life, whatever age that is, and pick out, I want you to view yourself at that age. And what would you say to that version of yourself? What advice, what would you express gratitude to that version of yourself? What would you say to that younger version of Marlon?
Probably I'd say when I got when I was presented with the opportunity to move to England and launched, you know, an office for the startup that I was working with right out of undergrad, having the courage to go move to that other country and take on this additional responsibility and do all these things, I think it was such a formative number of years for me, just being in a completely new environment, not knowing anyone there other than like the co-founder of the company that I was with, that where we didn't really hang out like that, right? So, you know, I would say thank you to, 22, 23 year old me for, you know, taking that risk. Because after that, I was comfortable taking all types of risks.
That's awesome.
And I don't think without that, you know, I don't think we're sitting here.
Marlon, you were quoted as saying, also, if you can't see it, you can't dream it. You can't dream it, you can't be it. And we need more Black people in leadership. I just love this. I love what you do, what you stand for. We could have spent a lot of time talking about your successful investments and where you've gotten today. But thank you so much for sharing some of your hero's journey with us and highlighting what's so great about you and what's so great about Cross Culture and what's so great about each one of the Coffin Fellows around the world. You're an inspiration to me and an inspiration to many. So thanks for spending your time with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And thanks for letting me be a fellow.
Hey, amen to that. Me too. All right. That's Marlon Nichols, general partner at Cross Culture Ventures. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Hey listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode with Marlon. As always, you can get notified of the latest release by subscribing or following our newsletter, which you can find in the bio below. That's all for now. We'll see you next week in the arena.